So today I'm in Bradford at the university with Dr. Lindsay Buster, who I've only just met, but we can ask the first question about, do we have any friends or acquaintances in common?
We do, Sarah George.
Sarah George, who's now a librarian here.
Yes, and she does a fantastic job for us, and she's very involved with the archaeology department, which is where I work.
And that is still, I think, if I say it, I think it might be her first love still. Yes, archaeology. Second question is, do you drink tea?
I do drink lots of tea. Yes, I think as an academic, it's the best form of procrastination. Drinking tea.
I went for an interview at Imperial once and they had a teapot in their common room for the lab, and it was a foot in diameter.
Fantastic.
And they all used to sit around and drink tea.
Brilliant.
All the time. Yeah.
Great.
What's your favourite cup of tea?
Oh, well, I'm not from Yorkshire originally, I'm from the Midlands originally, but I have to say I've lived in Yorkshire for about 10 years now and it's got to be Yorkshire tea.
Right.
Yeah, good, strong cup of Yorkshire tea.
I'm going to skip straight on to our specialist questions and we'll come back to the other question after that. So we're in an exhibition at the moment, so would you like to say something about the exhibition and the project as a whole?
Of course. So this exhibition is presenting some of the materials and some of the findings from a project that's been running for about the last 2 years at the university. It's a collaboration between archaeologists and healthcare professionals here at the University of Bradford and Loros Hospice in Leicester. And what it's trying to do is use archaeological materials to open up discussions around death, dying and bereavement in the present, particularly at the minute in this particular project amongst healthcare professionals, so those working in end-of-life care. I've been responsible for putting together some of the case studies, some of the archaeological materials, which showcase diverse attitudes to death, dying and bereavement, and diverse death practices across the world and through time. So we've got everything from mummification in Egypt to plastered skulls in the Neolithic Near East, to modern day examples, including Facebook legacy pages and cremation jewellery. And we're really juxtaposing these against each other to get people thinking, to get people talking, and to get people challenging some of their own preconceptions about death, dying and bereavement in the present. So the current exhibition, which has been on all week during Dying Matters Awareness Week, which is a national initiative, is really showcasing some of those materials, some of the reactions that we've had to them, and some of our preliminary findings about whether or not archaeology can help open up some of these discussions. And it seems to be working. We seem to have had very positive feedback in that archaeology creates a sort of safe and distant platform from which people can start thinking about these difficult topics and then start thinking about their own experiences and their own fears and their own expectations.
It's kind of like removing it from the immediacy of them, I guess.
Exactly. Very quickly, we've found that the discussions come back to the immediate and the present, but it needs that distance as a catalyst. We found it much easier to open up these discussions using the archaeology than we would have just walking into a cafe or a pub and saying, hey, how do you fancy talking about death this afternoon?
Have you got a favourite case study or a most interesting case study, something that you think, I wish that could happen to my remains, or how did they ever do that?
Oh, it's difficult. I've researched so many different case studies. And there's so many different ways in which people have treated the dead in the past. I have to say, I'm ironically perhaps, as the person putting all of this stuff together, still quite unsure about what I want. So I'm encouraging people to have these conversations and I'm quite happy to have them. But I'm still pretty on the fence about what I want. But we've got, lots of examples from inhumation with grave goods, so something that you might have today, cremation in vessels or in the modern day, putting cremation ashes into things like jewellery, diamonds, or even tattoos. You can have cremation ashes put into tattoo ink, if you like. Obviously, we've got mummification in Egypt. I mentioned the plastered skulls from the Neolithic Near East. This was a practice whereby people were buried under house floors for a time, and later, when they had skeletonized, the skull was retrieved, and then a plaster face lovingly recreated over the skull, and very detailed little eyelashes put on with pigment and things like that. So recreating the face of your relative or ancestor, and presumably these things were then kept within the household and passed around and used to tell stories with about ancestors. And when we find them deposited, they've been broken and repaired. So, you know, these were things that were actively used. We think about today, the dead resting in peace and being, you know, being left alone. But actually, in quite a lot of the practices in the past, I think they were considered very much to still have a definite role and function to play, and they were quite often put to work in the world of the living still. But yes, as for me, still on the fence.
So I sent you quite a biblical question, but it comes from a non-biblical start. So some time ago, I was watching the Neil Oliver program on Britain.
Yeah.
And he was talking about how when people started to enclose fields for farming, the nomads were pretty upset. And there was a lot of violence between the nomads and the farmers who were enclosing. And I thought that was really interesting from the biblical point of view, because the first 11 chapters of the Bible are stories which essentially are really, really ancient and try to explain what being human is about. Right. And the first story, the first death in the Bible, is when the nomadic person kills the farmer.
Right. Yeah.
They're the first two people, and the nomad kills the farmer. And I just thought that is really interesting that somehow in the an oral history has retained what we kind of understand from the archaeological record. So I just wanted to share that with an archaeologist.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I'm sure. I mean, the Bible is in itself probably, you know, a historical document in itself. So it probably does reflect, you know, the reality of that, of those times. And
I guess it's that kind of understanding that bit before we have any archaeological, we don't have any archaeological evidence before the story of Abraham, but there's these kind of 11 chapters trying to explain what it means to be human. I was just intrigued that the first human death in the narrative is a violent death.
That is interesting.
Caused by jealousy and kind of backed up by that kind of understanding of what was happening in ancient times.
Yeah, absolutely. That is really interesting. Yeah. So, and I think of all the case studies that we've shown as part of the project, we have touched on violent death and unexpected death and lives cut short death. And these are the things that stick in people's memories, and they are the things that have caused the strongest reactions for people, these sort of violent and life cut short deaths. So they are the things that tend to stick historically.
I think that we have an expectation that people won't die.
Yeah, definitely. And I think part of this project fits into broader narratives about the increasing medicalisation of death in the 21st century, and that death is somehow seen as medical failure, and that there are attempts now to preserve life at all costs. And that is, you know, in a lot of cases the right thing to do, but thinking about quality of life versus length of life, and things like that. I suppose this project speaks to broader narratives that are happening nationally and internationally at the minute about getting people to think of death as a natural part of life, and that it's not a failure, you know, that it happens to everybody, and that it's not a medical failure to die, especially at a ripe old age, you know, when you've had a nice long life.
We had a situation quite a few years ago now, where a 10-year-old in one of our villages died very suddenly, and she was really good friends with one of the pastors of the Evangelical Church. So he took the service in our church building, because our church building was biggest, and we had about 500 people in the building. And he stood up and said this most remarkable thing, and he was so brave in saying it, because it is absolutely true in Christian theology, but people are not brave enough. And he said, well, this little girl, she's the only one who's really alive. All the rest of us are dying. And I thought, wow, that sits within our... that's our Christian theology about life after death, and about dying being part of an eternal life. That sits really well. But that was just such a challenge to how we think about death.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. To sort of flip it on its head like that, you know.
That was really interesting. And I was wondering about continuation, how people think about being connected to the dead and the past. And I think that ties in with this project. And I don't know if there's any difference, even archaeologically, about urban and more rural settings. Partly because I guess I've been vicar of rural places, and people feel very connected to the people that have lived there for a long time. In particular, one of the villages where we lived, we would read off the names off the war memorial, which in itself is quite a poignant thing to do when you've got everybody together. But they would be the same names, surnames as the cubs. They were all connected, and that they had a strong connection. But in urban settings, do people get lost from that, do you think?
I think there probably is a difference. Just to touch on the sort of that idea of continuing bonds, the name of our project is Continuing Bonds, and it deals quite specifically about different cultures' approaches to maintaining that link between the living and the dead across cultures. And as I've said, there's lots and lots of different ways that people have done that today. Cremation jewellery, perhaps in the Neolithic Near East, the plastered skulls. But yes, I think probably there is a difference between rural and urban settings. Certainly to draw that into a more modern perspective, you know, the medicalisation of death, mm-hmm. I think, is very much a product of increasing populations and increasing population density and urban settings, and that death is something that is given over to specialists, undertakers, palliative care specialists. And I think in a rural setting where the communities are much tighter knit, and where communities are much smaller, a lot of that care and a lot of that post-mortem care probably does take place within the family and within homes. Certainly, you know, very recently, that kind of thing still happened. And I think there is a push, again, nationally now to try and take more communal responsibility for the elderly and for the dying and for some of this care, and to come together as communities, and in much the same way that rural communities always have done, but to sort of foster this kind of sentiment within larger urban populations, to bring death back inside the home, back inside families, and to not to parcel it off to specialists. I know there's some people that say that seeing a dead body is one way in which perhaps the grieving process is kick-started in acknowledging that death. And certainly seeing a dead body makes it much, much harder to deny to deny that death. And some people say actually it might actually help in kick-starting the grieving process. It's probably not for everybody, but there are people that suggest that families caring for their dying and deceased relatives might be a useful thing for them.
So the question that I'm asking everybody is, how do you respond to the statement Christianity in the UK is not dying but sleeping? And I know that's probably quite a difficult question for you, but I was just thinking in this context, did you see people in the workshops bringing in Christian or other sentiments, or how was it affecting their thinking?
Certainly, actually, most of our cohort, and this probably reflects the people that are employed at end of life care, most of our cohort were middle-aged, middle-class white females, and the a significant proportion of those were Christian, either Catholic or another denomination. And certainly that did have, I think, quite strong bearings on how some of them reacted to the materials. And I think having exposure to some of these materials maybe made them more aware of some of the things that they bring to the table when they're having discussions with patients about death, dying and bereavement, and allowed them to sort of articulate some of these materials through that lens of their own religion. Mm. So certainly a lot of people who came to the workshops were of Christian faith, certainly. Mm. And I think that probably reflects the broader cohort of people who are employed in end-of-life care, actually, which was an interesting finding in itself.
I guess, I don't know what the influence of the hospice movement has been on kind of end-of-life care, but that grew out of a very strong Christian basis.
Yeah.
So that, I think that the legacy of that still
certainly
carries on in our hospice movements.
I think there is a much greater awareness now that it's not just the physical needs mm-hmm. of dying patients and their families that need catering for, but it's actually the spiritual and emotional needs as well, which are as important, if not more important. So certainly I can see that winding its way through.
The last question. I've got, in the back of my head, I've got something that I'm hoping you're going to say, but it might be different. What's your favourite thing that begins with tea?
Oh, see, that's pressure now.
Everybody what's struggles with this question.
What's my favourite thing that begins with tea? I'm trying to think. I'm just thinking tea now. I'm just thinking tea that's sat in front of me.
That is allowed as an answer. And then I'll tell you what I hoped you were going to say.
Go on.
I hoped you were going to say Thebes.
Do you know what? That did pop into my head because the guy that I've been talking about, the mummification guy, sat right in front of me on the desk, is from Thebes, actually. So there you go. I could have said trowel as well, couldn't I, as an archaeologist? It's all coming back to
it's
me now.
It's all now.
Coming now. Trowel, Thebes, all of these things. Yes, Tutankhamun.
Wow. You know, yeah, there are lots of good archaeological things that begin with T.
Exactly. Edit out the first answer. Tutankhamun.
I might have to leave it in because it makes better radio. That's the end of the question. So thank you ever so much for inviting me here today.
No problem, and thanks for coming to see the exhibition.